If you want to get your favorite technical news, give the Gizmo Gang a call. Gizmo Sapiens.
Hey, and welcome to Gizmo Sapiens Show 189. We're actually entitling this one Maverick after the new Ford Maverick. If you've not taken a look at that truck, it is amazing. The Ford Maverick used to be a pretty hot Ford muscle car. And they brought it back as a truck form based on the same chassis as the Ford Bronco, the new Ford Bronco. But this one has a 4.5-foot bed, a crew cab. It's a hybrid. And it is... also front-wheel drive, which you don't find in trucks, pickup trucks. But probably the most amazing thing for them is that the base model starts at $19,990, so you can actually walk out of a dealership with one of these for less than $22,000-$23,000, you know, after you add taxes and delivery fees and all that stuff. I've been waiting for this to happen. I think this is a significant moment. Where the issue with driving adoption has always been, and I don't know why everybody thinks that, you know, giving rebates and, you know, tax rebates and all this other stuff, that can help because it does address part of the issue. But the issue is the prices on these things have to come down to what people can afford and what the market will bear. It's economics. This Ford truck is essentially hitting those economic, it's come the closest to hitting what I consider the affordable mark of vehicles. If you're buying a brand new vehicle, I also think what'll happen is after the 2022 model year, just like when 2006, when Chevy brought out the HHR, the next year, they raised the cost of that vehicle by about $7,000. So what was a reasonably costing vehicle then all of a sudden got a price bump. And I wonder if Ford will do that. They might keep it this way for a couple of years, but it's a pretty impressive vehicle. And when they talk base model, they're still talking Apple CarPlay stereo, air conditioning, which should be standard on any vehicle, automatic transmission, which is really the de facto standard today. It actually costs more to get a manual transmission than anything anymore. You get 4G hotspot. You get the automatic braking system for if you're going to be in a collision and head-on collision with something else, or rear head-to-rear collision with something else. And then it's only $500 more to add the 360-degree sensors to let you know if people are passing, don't change lanes, and all of that. Very, very reasonable, particularly for a truck. New trucks have not been that cheap since probably the 80s. Because we are still talking about a pickup truck, and it's a hybrid. So you're meeting the goals of better fuel economy, has regenerative braking, it's moving that let's get to electric vehicle things down the road. But the advantage of it is being a hybrid is you don't plug it in to charge it. and you can, you don't have to change the infrastructure of your house to support it, like a Tesla or a Nissan Leaf or a multitude of these other electric vehicles that are out there. Now, there is a niche that still needs to be filled. In the U.S., we don't have many options below $20,000, even if it's a passenger car, a compact passenger car. $20,000 is about the lowest you're going to get on a new vehicle. There needs to be somebody who does and I think hybrid is better than full electric, particularly at this point. Because of this, what I said before, about not having to add a charging infrastructure at your house, you know, it actually charges itself either via regenerative braking or it uses the motor when the battery gets too low. But we definitely need a vehicle that's going to fit into that $10,000, $12,000 range as a new vehicle in this space, and I think hybrid might be the way to go. It's not going to come from Ford. The only car Ford makes anymore is the Mustang. And that's why the Maverick went from being a muscle car to a truck, which is going to, in the United States, more people drive SUVs and minivans and crew cab trucks than probably anywhere else in the world. And Ford's going to do just fine. But it also addresses the issues, you know, of this transition from a gasoline-powered infrastructure with gas stations and oil refineries, which oil refineries are not going to go away just because people quit using gasoline. We use oil for plastics and polymers and all kinds of other things. You're still going to have a need for diesel for locomotives and for heavy equipment, machinery, and large trucks. You know, the majority of our trucking fleet in the United States and or farm vehicles, which includes tractors and three-quarter and full-ton pickup trucks, are going to be diesel. Although we're also going to see a fair share of those pickup trucks and tractors be gasoline as well. I don't see the pressure on John Deere and Ford and or New Holland to produce, or Kubota, to produce farm equipment that uses electric. It just doesn't seem to be there. Tesla has their medium range semi-tractors that are electric, but I have not ever seen one. I see more Teslas driving around as the Model 3 has become kind of the de facto model for low-end electric from them. But I also saw the base model price of a Tesla Model 3 go from $29,990 to about $37,000-$38,000, which it makes, again, in this economy, that's exponentially making it unaffordable.
Well, and that's, you know, you brought up the point of the niche that's missing being that $10,000 to $20,000 dollar range.
Well, I really think it should be 10 to 12 should be that range. There's no car in the United States that you can buy new in that range. And the thing is used cars prices are so expensive here for multiple reasons. I mean, just the fact that you can't get new cars because of the logistics issues. We are exporting used cars, the higher end used cars. They're going over to Tunisia and Northern Africa because they don't buy new cars there. They buy our cast-offs. And they're getting new prices, new type of money for cars that are 5 to 10 years old in good shape. You know? And then also the fact that steel is so sought after right now. There's even used cars at junkyards. So getting parts is really tough because junkyards, it's cheaper for them to crush the cars and sell off the steel than it is to keep the cars. A relative of mine, they run a junkyard, and they had about 8,000 vehicles, and they're now down to like 700 because they've crushed like 7,300 vehicles, and they're not alone. That's the industry. You know, and junkyards are not the same as they used to be. It's not like in a junkyard today, they allow you to go out there and dig through a car, you know, the cars and find pieces and parts you need. And then you bring them back and you haggle over the price. Now they bring the cars in, they take off all the parts that they know are worth something. It's cataloged. They keep them on the shelf, and then the husk of the car goes out in the junkyard. And, you know, only certain pieces and parts that are rare would somebody go out and pull that for you. And the prices are kind of fixed and set because the junkyard industry had to change to stay alive. Go ahead, Matt. You were going to say something?
Well, I mean, the point that I was making was somewhat political, and that's that with inflation and the state of the economy, it's becoming less and less likely that the auto industry will survive unless it does bring the price of a vehicle down.
And that's absolutely true. You know, If there are not vehicles at the low end, again, well, there's a couple things, both economically and politically, that are happening. If they don't bring vehicles down, and it can't just be one manufacturer doing it. It's going to have to be a couple so that there's some competition. But they need to bring some vehicles down into that. It would be great if we could get to like an $89.99 or $89.99 base price and, you know, a fully loaded model of some ultra compact or subcompact or whatever car would be like $12,000. One, with the inflation happening, more and more people aren't going to be able to afford the $20,000 vehicles.
Yeah.
You already have this disparity with the haves and the have-nots on vehicles today anyway, and you're starting to see a lot more vehicles that maybe shouldn't be roadworthy on the road, because people can't afford to upgrade them, even to another new used vehicle that's in better shape. Because, again, like I said before, the prices are high because a lot of market factors are going on. But politically, too, you're going to see, if the inflation doesn't stop and the prices don't come down on things, you know, you're going to see a increase in unemployment because people can't get to work. United States, people complain about public transportation in the United States, but wherever we've put public transportation, it tends to bus our crime around or train our crime around and provide easy escape for criminals. But also, the United States is expansive. There's, I mean, other than the former Soviet Union, there was not a country as large. And actually, I think Canada would have the same issue because they have half the population. But you can't, you know, if a job is in, you know, Indianapolis and you live in Columbus, Ohio, without a car, there's no way, there's no good way to, you know, public transportation would take you longer to get there anyway if there wasn't available. It's not like we're a single country. Our country is the size of Great Britain, where, you know, the Dorset and the southern tip of Great Britain can be reached by bus or by train.
Yeah.
You know? And also, the majority of people in those countries live in a very few large cities. Living out in a rural town or village is much... much in some respects is much less common, although they are starting to get subdivisions in Great Britain, very much like the subdivisions in the United States, as the population wants to move away from being crowded in the major cities like Manchester and London. London's kind of weird. London, it's a neat city because of the history and everything there, but it has kind of grown into its own suburbs. So, you know, Croydon and Wimbledon and all these places, which were really little villages of their own, are really part of the greater London metroplex. And it's kind of like Jefferson County in Kentucky, which is the whole city of Louisville, or the county that the city of Indianapolis lives in is actually the city government is the county government. Because other than one little section where the Indianapolis Speedway is, that's all the city of Indianapolis, the whole county. So, have any remarks?
Well, I was just, you know, I was just thinking, you know, the part of this, I think, is by design. The left here wants us off cars and into high-speed rail. So, you know, you're talking about that trip from Columbus to Indianapolis. I've heard about that route being one that they want to build high-speed rail.
Oh, I've heard all kinds of stories about high-speed rail and all this stuff, but I think I talked about it a couple episodes ago when we were talking about transportation and car-related things. The U.S. government is horrible. Since they took over Amtrak, they run at a operating loss every year. Why does Amtrak exist? And because the U.S. government took over Amtrak, or created Amtrak, and they bought out all the other rail freight companies' passenger lines, there's no competition in the market.
Well, and that's why it fails.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, you're not going to...
Well,
you're not going to get true high-speed rail by having the government do it.
No, no.
It won't be high-speed or rail.
It'll be broken most of the time.
Exactly. It's not going to function the way it will be promised.
Well, the other thing is, high-speed rail... I mean, there are some neat things about rail, like particularly if you... Like the East Coast has a good rail system going from Washington, D.C. to New York City. You can work on the train. You know, you can get up, stand up, and walk around. But the pricing for a lot of that is cheaper to get on an airplane and spend a half hour. You may not be able to work during that half hour to fly from D.C. to New York City, but it's a half hour. It's not 4 hours on a train.
Yeah.
You know, so you can go for a 2 hour meeting and then ride 4 hours home. Or 2 hours one way. It's a huge commute. And it's questionable, even at that point, whether it's not better to just get in your car and go.
There's reasons why I'm driving to Indianapolis this week.
I would always drive from Indianapolis. I mean, the other big issue is part of the reason that passengers...
I've got colleagues flying from Ohio.
That's out of hand.
Yeah.
But part of the reason... passenger trains were being phased out by all of the freight haul or train companies was because there were fewer and fewer passengers. There were other alternatives that made more sense, like cars, like airplanes. You know, the airline industry had started. And it's not like everybody thinks about Amtrak. It's not like Amtrak was created back like in the 20s or 30s. Amtrak was created in the late 60s, early 70s. And Amtrak only owns 5 miles. It's more than 5 miles, but they own less than 100 miles worth of track. They lease track from all of the other companies. So it doesn't make sense.
Which is why it fails. And that's why the reason they're able to do that is because they're a government operation. If they were a legitimate business, they
would be function. No, they wouldn't function. They'd be shut down because they would go bankrupt. And that's really where it is. It should just be shut down. If there is such demand for passenger rail travel in the United States, one of the current rail companies who haul freight today, which by the way, hauling freight by train is the cheapest way to haul freight. In the United States, other than by barge. Barge is the only one that's cheaper. But unless you have a big river like the Ohio or the Mississippi, you aren't hauling by barge. So that means that it's very possible that a freight train could add a passenger car on if there was need for it. You know, and there might be, you know, you might start seeing some of it. But it's also, you know, the problem with rail is that train track is rigid.
Mm-hmm.
And it can only go, if you make a train track from Cincinnati to Columbus or Cincinnati and Indianapolis or Columbus to Indianapolis, those are the only places you're going on that rail. You know, so unless you're going from big city to big city to big city, which are much farther apart outside of the very East Coast, because almost all the major cities, like if you go up from Richmond, Virginia, and it even goes farther south than this, but I just happen to know this. If you go from Richmond, Virginia to Washington, D.C. to Annapolis, Maryland, and you just keep going up to each major big city all the way up to New York City, that distance, those cities were actually spaced out intentionally so that it was no longer than one day's horse ride to go from Richmond to D.C. and another day from D.C. to Annapolis and another day from Annapolis to, or actually it wasn't Annapolis, it was to Baltimore, I'm sorry. But, you know, those major cities, because they were also major ports, and so that made sense. But that only made sense when we were the 13 colonies. Today, we're the 50 states. And even if you did that, like to get to Alaska via train, high-speed rail would mean you'd have to hope that Canada has high-speed rail. You know? And the other thing is so like our freight companies, we're seeing a consolidation in the market. Right now, there's a bidding war between, is it Canada Western Freight and Canada Eastern something? But they're both Canadian railway companies trying to buy one of the U.S. railway companies that does cargo because, again, consolidation in the industry. They have the money. They want the routes and they want to own the track. I think they should shut down Amtrak. If the government wanted to do something, is they would shut down Amtrak and they would take the money from Amtrak and they would build track that is government owned, like the highway system. To me, that makes more sense.
Yeah.
And so the government owns the railway, railways, and then train companies pay to use them. I think that would make much more sense. And the money that they would pay would be like usage fees so that you could keep the railway maintained. And it should be a sum zero effect that they're collecting enough money. It's not too expensive for the railways to pay the fee and they're collecting enough money to keep it maintained. You want sum zero. You don't want it, you know, they don't need an excess of money that then they can, you know, some other part of the government can borrow and then overborrows and doesn't ever pay back. And hence our Social Security debacle. But that seems to me the way it should work, but it doesn't.
But that's because we don't have, when's the last time we actually had a transportation secretary that knew what transportation really is?
Well, that's true. That goes to the point that most people in government are politicians. They're not qualified to actually do anything that, you know, that they're the secretary of this or the director of that or, you know, whatever. Because by the time they get to the point where they're at the top there, they're no longer worker bees or even specialists with the knowledge and understanding how it all works. They're all politicians. And while I don't begrudge appointments are part of the problem because people are put in place who are like, it's like political payback, you know? Look at Mitch McConnell's wife. That's a good example.
It absolutely is. You know, there's no reason for us to continue doing business this way.
No. Well, that's a whole nother argument about the government should be run more like a business in many aspects. But even more so to that, you then have to get to the fact that the government's just got its hands in things it doesn't need its hands in.
Well, I mean, you can run that all the way down to the micro level. I mean, it's...
Oh, yeah.
How many times have we had conversations off air about what law enforcement is responsible for currently?
And what they're doing, yeah.
Beyond their scope of expertise.
No, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's like that all through government. I mean... Every department and agency is got so much mission creep that they're no longer good at what they were supposed to be good at because they're focused on things that are not in their purview.
Yeah. Well, let's turn this a little bit because, I mean, I still want to keep this really about transportation. And, I mean, we have some transportation challenges in the United States. We don't have, from the personal transportation fund, it's more of an economic issue. I'm glad to see companies like Ford come out with affordable, desirable vehicles. But again, you know, this may be something very short-lived until, unless somebody else decides, like General Motors decides to put out a comparable vehicle. And it doesn't have to be a truck, but put something else out so that the prices stay low. Because if you're the only one doing it in a market, you know.
The other elephant in the room that hasn't come up yet is the supply chain has gotten so screwed with shipping container ships not being able to pull into port.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, as I was actually going to bring that up as part of this too, because anytime we switch, I mean, it's not like, I go back to the line from the Russian cosmonaut in Armageddon when he says, I'll go back and fix the shuttle. And he makes the comment as he's running the wrench across the electrical panel to get it to short and kick on, is, you know, American, Russian, it's all made in China.
Mm-hmm.
And although we manufacture the bodies out of sheet steel and things here in the United States, all the electronic components, the majority of them are made overseas. And so, I mean, I've said this before, Ford has a huge manufacturing facility for F-150s through F-350s in Louisville. And as you drive to Louisville, the Speedway, the Kentucky Speedway parking lots are just filled with trucks that don't have computer chips. So they meet the federal EcoBoost guidelines for fuel mileage. And I mean, it's not like it's, oh, there's 100 trucks parked here. There's thousands of trucks, and they've all been paid for, or they wouldn't have been manufactured, because they can't afford to make stuff on spec.
Right. But here's the other part of that. You're talking about chips that are being used to meet government specifications. Again, this is government getting involved in things that they should not be getting involved in. If there was a need in the market for those chips outside of the external force of government, we'd have them.
Yes, you're right.
We would manufacture them here. They'd be here.
Well, and part of that is, you know, the chip fabs, there's only so many in the world. They cost billions of dollars to build. They do make trillions of dollars in return, but it's not like a Walmart. You know, I can pay enough and get enough construction workers to build a Walmart in a month, build the, you know, physical structure. You know, it takes years to build these because they have to have clean rooms, and, you know, there's all, so building that is not something like you can turn around in a year, even, you know, it's a multi-year process.
But ignoring that problem long-term and just kicking the can down the road is not a solution.
What happened is the guys who use chips all the time, like Apple and Dell and Intel, and they know, because that's their business, they locked up all their contracts with these chip manufacturers. And so the auto industry, because even though they've been using computers and cars for years, one, their technology is considered really old, because they keep saying, the auto industry says it like this, which the government has said before too, but I don't believe them, which is, well, the newer stuff isn't as reliable. And I would beg to differ. I would say particularly in microcontrollers and chips, the newer stuff's probably a lot more reliable than the older stuff, because it has so much more engineering and testing in it. You know, the older stuff. And that's the other thing. These manufacturers are not geared to do the older stuff. They're geared to do the newer stuff, because that's where the money is. So come on, guys, embrace it. Tesla has. SpaceX has. Even Blue Origin has. But the other issue is to address the logistics thing, is what I think is kind of funny is the United States on the West Coast is primarily only utilizing the ports of Long Beach and LA. Mm-hmm. And so we have a huge backup. We've had an oil spill because of it, because an anchor dragged across a underwater oil line. But, you know, some of these ships, yeah, we're going to have a delay because they're going to have to go around the to the Panama Canal, but why are we not telling them, hey, we got all these empty ports in Florida. Florida, Savannah, New Jersey. I'm sure there's several other ports there. And why aren't there more ports on, like, why? I guess we may not have a rail system, a robust rail system to move material once it's there, but there are ports in Oregon and Washington, I believe.
I can't see why not.
I would think so. You know?
There has to be a reason why civilization went that far.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, why they stayed that far.
Yeah.
But, you know, it just doesn't make sense. You know, Ron DeSantis is telling them.
He's like, begging people, hey, I've got empty ports.
Come on I've got empty ports. Come on. And he has a way to move the material once he gets it there. So, you know, some of this doesn't make sense. And he's got dock workers. That's the other problem. L.A. legitimately has a L.A. and Long Beach have a legitimate shortage. They've had to go to 24/7 operations because they don't have enough people. But again,
I don't buy that argument at all because,
well, I don't buy the argument that they're not paying enough to get people. I just think there's a lot of people, because that state's become really socialist, that just don't want to work.
That's the point.
That's the problem with socialism. Is
don't get me wrong. I'm one of those people who believes that we have to have an immigration process that works for us.
Oh, I agree with that.
But I'm finding the anti-immigration line being less and less effective the longer it takes for the American people to go back to work.
Yes.
For whatever reason.
Oh, I totally agree with you with that.
National security implications aside.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
Clearly that's another whole thing. But from a purely economic standpoint, there's no reason not to bring people in who want to work here.
I agree. But, you know, it's a fine line between the people who want to come work, but then they want it, the country to act like where they came from.
Well, that's the other part of wokeism.
Yes.
For lack of a better term. I mean, we're a country for a reason. People want to come here for a reason.
Yeah.
Let's not, don't California my Ohio is my motto for a lot of this.
That's your slogan for your run for governor?
Pretty much. I mean, there's no reason to look. Ohio's got its problems. Our country has its problems. As a collective group of people, we have a responsibility to make things better.
Yes.
I get that. But what we can't do is allow people to come here from where they left that didn't work.
Yes, you're right. Absolutely. Well, and that's the way the immigration process was back in in the 1800s was, you know, these are the skilled trades we need, you know, and we will accept a certain number of other people. But, you know, they were essentially, you were brought in because this is what we lack and what we needed, not because we just had open immigration policy.
Yes.
You know? Right now, the immigration policy, and this will be the last thing I say about it, because it's not really about transportation, but the immigration policy is being used as a political weapon as opposed to actually making a smart decision for the country.
Agreed. And it's been that way for decades?
Yeah. Yep.
It's about winning elections,
not solving a problem.
Exactly.
Yep. Well, I don't think we're going to solve any problems discussing this anymore. Go and check out Ford's website. Look at the Maverick. Actually, look at the Bronco. I mean, yeah, it's a $30,000 base vehicle, but it's a good vehicle. Check out Tesla's Model 3. Even if you're not looking for a vehicle, it's just interesting to look at what's out there and what's going on. Because, again, the industry has had to adapt and change. And so there's some exciting things coming to cars that you should be aware of. You know, it's different than, you know, particularly if you're around, you know, in your late 40s to mid 50s, vehicles for a long time, they looked nicer and newer and became more streamlined, but there wasn't much difference between a 1980 Buick and a 1995 Buick. There was really about a 20 or more year period where the cars, there wasn't much difference in them. You know, the radio became digital was the big difference. So we want to hear from you, and we thank you for listening. So please send us some feedback to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. Or visit our website at www.gizmosapiens.com, and we'll see you on the digital flip side.
You've been listening to Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.